year for Southern Writers, sir.
Who else came up?
Oh, gosh, I've had a lot. I had, last week I had Lewis Grizzard.
No kidding.
You know Lewis?
Lewis is in Atlanta. I know Lewis.
Yeah, and Mark Childress, also another.
I know Atlanta. Mark very well.
Young, very young guy, wrote his first novel.
A World Made of Fire.
A World Made of Fire. Roy Blunt, who lives up here now, and I think he's got a farm up in
very funny
Massachusetts.
How is Lewis doing? He was, you know, Lewis had heart operations and everything else.
I didn't know that.
He had two of them.
Did you read his book?
I've not read his book. Is it good?
A memoir about his father.
Is it a good book?
I thought it was. Boy, he's a dynamite writer.
He's, you know, he's a funny man too. He's very funny.
He's formed his own production outfit, Lewis Grizzard Productions or something.
No kidding.
And he has a manager.
Lewis has a manager?
Yeah,
he
brought the young man with him, and I said, well, what is your relationship with Lewis? This young man was following him around. I thought he was just a friend at first, but then I realized it was a little more than that because he went out to make telephone calls and this sort of thing. He said, well, actually, I'm Lewis's manager. Lewis hired me to manage his affairs.
Jesus Christ.
He said,
I can't wait to tease
films.
Lewis about that. I absolutely
can't. I was kidding him, too. I said, gee, you know, most people I talk to, they might have an agent, but... a manager goes around with them. I mean, that's great. That's a wonderful thing. Well, let's talk about you. We talk about other writers anytime, but The Prince of Tides, is this a proper book for a Christian to read?
You've heard from Aunt Helen, I can tell already. I have a certain part of my family that reads my books not with a literary, critical sensibility, but with a religious sensibility. And many of my relatives around Piedmont, Alabama, especially, are Southern Baptists of a very proper sort. And they simply go crazy every time a book of mine comes out. The language, if there's any mention of human sexuality, anything at all, I get immediate book reviews from these relatives, and especially my Aunt Helen, who once said, I think you have enough talent to write a book someday that even a Christian could read.
Well, you've obviously rocked your family with your work because so much of it is semi-autobiographical. Of course, you've had so many interesting experiences that you just had to draw on. For example, Tom Wingo in The Prince of Tides has an outsider's naivete about New York. When he comes in, he says, what a crap hole New York is. In fact, he and his brother, the first night that they're in New York, they run across a mugger and subdue the mugger, and the second night they find a junkie dead on a bench. And more violence actually has happened to Tom in his rural North Carolina upbringing through his teens than has happened to me in 50 years, almost half of it spent in New York. But I don't think that some of the violence that you depict in The Prince of Tides, for example, the lion going after the rapist,
the tiger
going after the rapist, actually happened. I can't really. I mean, a wonderful chapter in the book, but I can't. What did it happen?
Here's what happened with the tiger. I grew up in South Carolina, and the tiger that I drew on was Happy the Tiger. It was in a gas station in Columbia, South Carolina. Its owner bought Happy when Esso came out with their little ad campaign, put a tiger in your tank. So he had the only tiger in an Esso station in the country. Happy later, and I followed Happy's story because as a kid it was always exciting to see a tiger when your dad went to fill up with gas. The SPCA got mad that they had Happy in this little cage. They took Happy to the Columbia Zoo, where the other tigers beat Happy up because it was a car wash tiger by this time. They kept putting Happy in smaller and smaller cages because he was miserable. Till finally, they had to put him in a cage the exact size of the one he grew up with at the car wash. Happy still didn't make it. What I learned was that they finally had to put a tape of a car wash before Happy was happy at the zoo. I remember this story when I was sitting in Rome, Italy, next to a woman with one arm. And I said, how'd you lose that arm? And she said, a tiger tore it off when I got too near its cage at the zoo. And this is when I realized, as I was writing this book, that I didn't realize a tiger was that strong. And I realized that I had a tiger in a backyard as these rapists came to this house. And this is the imaginary road it took of putting all that stuff together.
My God, you really have borrowed on your own experiences and observations, haven't you? You really have.
Well, you know, America is a great place for stories. You know, when I come to New York, people tell me the marvelous stories I've ever heard. I wish I was born in New York. I'd love to write a New York novel. because I figure if there was that many towns, that many stories coming out of these small towns south that I grew up in, I couldn't imagine how many stories would be coming out of this city.
Well, you have practically have written the New York story. So much of the Prince of Tides is set in that.
If I could only have grown up here, I would have collected a lot more.
But nobody who grows up in New York really writes about it. It takes people from outside to look at the city in a way to write about it, I think. I'm not sure about that. I'm trying to think of all the New York writers that I know who were born here. And while the city is loaded with writers, they almost all have come from out of town.
Is that right?
I think so.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I've not met most of them, so that would surprise me.
I think
great
most
deal.
Of the New York writers want to escape and go someplace else, and maybe that's true. Maybe they can look at the city from a different perspective. But Updike was telling me that he loves to come to New York. He did live here at one point shortly after he graduated from Harvard to work on the New Yorker, and he says he loves to come to New York because he can walk down a street and he can see five stories a block, even. Oh, I can't remember her name, but she's another Southern writer whose first name starts with Anne. It's right on the tip of my tongue. I'll remember before we leave. But she stays with Roy Blunt sometimes up on the west side. She was looking out of Roy's window, and she saw a mugger stalking a person down on the street. And she kept watching this, and I told her, I said, well, you have a story there already. I mean, it's something that you can put in it, because the story seems to be happening every minute. But in actuality, stories are where you find them, and in some respects, growing up in a rural area, it would seem to be, would make living there so much more vivid, because there are fewer distractions, fewer things perhaps going around, so the things that do happen are so much stronger in your mind. Well, that's only a theory.
You know, I think when you come up to New York as a writer, it drives me crazy, because I'm seeing so much, and there's so much coming in, that in a small town, you would see one thing come in. And at the same time, in New York, 10 things are registering. You know, the truck running over, the thing that makes a loud cannon-like noise in the street, the cab driver screaming, the honking going on. And I think for a writer who has acclimated himself to try to absorb everything, New York can be one of the most exhausting cities in the world and one of the most stimulating.
Try living here for a bit. Rome, you just got back from Rome. What was that like?
My wife and I were living over there with four of our children. And they're going to high school over there, and we're going to probably be over there about 3 years.
Why did you decide to do that?
Well, instead of being a Southern writer, I'm going to have this European continental air the next time you see me, and I'll be very urbane, civilized.
That's what Styron did. He went over there to live in Rome.
That's what he did. This is about 20 years ago. So anyway, we wanted our kids to have a chance to live overseas for a while, see what that would be like, see how that would broaden their perceptions. And so far, it seems to be working out fairly well.
Culture shock?
There's a lot of that. I'm not kidding you. There's a lot of that.
How do they receive you as an American and a Southerner?
Well, they simply, because I speak the language with the gift of a two-year-old child, they sort of see me as I wander around my neighborhood as a gangling, brawling, idiot savant that they cannot figure out what I'm doing over there, how I make my living.
But you have been living in Atlanta.
Yes, been living in Atlanta for about 10 years.
The Citadel, where you graduated, that sounds like an unlikely place for a writer to develop. Tell me how that developed.
My father was a Marine Corps fighter pilot, and I grew up going around the bases in the South with him, Camp Lejeune, Parris Island. So Dad was not the type of father who would say, then, son, where would you like to go to college? He said, son, I have chosen a college for you. It's the Citadel. And so he sent me to the Military College of South Carolina and did not get any advice and consent from his son at all. And he just said, this is where you're going, this is where you're going to be. And the Citadel, in truth, has not produced many writers, but it produced this one.
How?
I don't know. I can't. They are wondering the same thing, because they tremble every time I write a book, just like my family does. And it doesn't make sense, but my mother raised me to be a Southern writer. She just raised me up that way. And she said, I want you to be a writer. She told me this from a very early age, and I don't know how she thought about it, because there are members of our family that aren't that good with the alphabet. But my mother had this particular dream that she wanted to raise somebody that could write.
Of course, you did use the Citadel as the location for your book, The Lords of Discipline, so you did take advantage, certainly, of your 4 years there.
As they would say, I exploited them.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. Actually, you wrote your first book, didn't you? Was it while you were going to the Citadel?
It was right after I graduated. I wrote a book called The Boo, which, if you haven't heard of it, it makes you a majority on the planet. And I published that book myself. And it was my first experience in publishing.
What was that about?
It was about the assistant commandant of cadets when I was at the Citadel. Colonel Cavorsi, who was called The Boo by the cadets, was fired. And he was a wonderful man who was very nice to me when I was at the school. And I asked him, I said, Colonel, I always want to be a writer. If you ever want to write these stories down, I know you have lots of them, just give me a call. So after I wrote the book, I was sitting in his house in Charleston. And he said, Bubba, you're an English major. How do we go about getting a book published? And I said, Colonel, I have no cotton picking idea. And he smoked a cigar for a while, and then he said, and I swear this is true, he said, let's look in the Yellow Pages. Which he did. And in the Yellow Pages, under printing, we found a company that said invitations, business cards, books. So I went down. I said, look, I've got this book I want published. They said, wonderful. $1,500? We'll give you 500 copies. So I went to Willie Shep in the Beaufort Bank. I said, Willie, I wrote this book by the Citadel. He was a Citadel graduate. And I said, I need $1,500. He said, great. This is wonderful. Gave me the $1,500. And I published my first book and thought I had discovered the secret of publishing on the first time out and had no idea that people do not normally publish or pay for their own books.
So you wound up with 500 copies.
Wound up with 500 copies and sold them.
How?
The one thing, one of the secrets of publishing is to find something that no one else has written about that people do want to read about. The Citadel people wanted to read about the Citadel, and they simply had no other books to read.
So you stocked the book in your dormitory room?
Stocked the book and sold it in the cadet bookstore, and we've eventually sold 4,000 of them.
All self-published books?
Oh, this was the same book, all self-published. So we just kept reprinting.
So you had subsequent editions?
Yes.
You were, what, a junior, senior?
It was right after my senior year that I began writing this.
So you were no longer directly affiliated with the...
That's right.
Would have had some problems.
I would not have been allowed to publish it.
Was the book critical of the Citadel?
Oh, it was a little critical. Not as much as it was, the discipline was.
Mm-hmm. Then, you graduated from the Citadel and you became an English teacher.
That's right. And a coach.
Yeah, well, your father probably didn't mind the coaching, but what about the English?
Dad always thought because I majored in English in college, it was an open admission that I was gay. And he just considered that just one thing following the other. And for a fighter pilot, he could never understand anybody, you know, a boy majoring in English. And it was the same reason he did not allow me to type or take typing when I was in high school. That was a girls' course. And there would always be girls to type for you, son. And that decision has cost me more money than any other one my father's made in my lifetime.
You made up for it, though. You took along the line a typing course.
No, I've never learned to type, and I still handwrite all my books.
Is that right? You can learn.
They tell me that, but now I've done it so long, it looks funny and it feels funny. It doesn't feel right for a word to come out of a machine when it's always come out with my hand connected to a pen connected to the paper. And now it's habitual, and now I can't do anything about it.
But it's so time-consuming. This book is 567 pages, handwritten?
Handwritten.
Then you have to find somebody to actually type it.
Actually type it.
You ought to learn to type and use a word processor of some kind.
Can you do that yet? Can you do the word processor? Most of my friends are writing books in word processors right now.
I could not go back to it. You look around you, you'll see these things. They took our typewriters away from us.
They're gone. Then.
We have two, I think. One here, it's on rollers, just in case everything goes down. And I couldn't go back to a typewriter today.
All my writer friends tell me they cannot do it either.
I have to give you an admission. I only use two fingers and a thumb. And I taught myself to type when I was six. When I was a junior in college, they said I could no longer take any journalism courses, so I proved I could touch type. And they forced me to take a touch typing course, which I cheated in, and I still type with two fingers. So it can be done, even if it's two fingers and a thumb.
I never heard of the two-finger thumb method.
Well, now, after you finished The Boo and you began working as a teacher, now, of course, the story is pretty well known because there's a lot of press material that Houghton Mifflin sent over, but it's really kind of an interesting story. You began working in a very rural school district on an island, and this, of course, became the subject for your next book. What led up to writing that book?
Well, I took this job teaching the first year of teacher integration in South Carolina. And this was on Dufusky Island, an all-black school, where I became integration on this particular school. So I went over there, found kids who did not know what country they lived in, did not know what state they lived in, thought that Savannah, Georgia was the largest city in the world, which wasn't so bad, but they thought Bluffton, South Carolina was the second largest city. So I came to this place of almost primeval innocence, and these kids that had been, behind in a tragic way. So I taught for a year, and then I was fired for gross neglect of duty by the superintendent of schools. So I went racing home.
What didn't you do?
This, I irritated him. I made him angry. And he was the classic, he was a cliche racist of the South at that particular time. And he irritated me, and I irritated him, but he had more power. So he got rid of me. And I went home, and I thought I was going to publish the book the same way I did The Boo, that I was going to go to the bank, get a loan, and throw the book on every doorstep in Beaufort. Because people kept asking me, why'd you get fired? And I couldn't answer them in 2 minutes. I could not say that this happened. So as I was writing the book, I met a writer from New Jersey who happened to be coming through town who told me I needed a New York agent. He gave me Julian Bach's number in New York. I called Julian. Julian was enraged. You can imagine an agent getting... He said, I've never heard of South Carolina, barely. I've never heard of Beaufort in my life. Get off the phone. But he agreed as a courtesy to this writer. He agreed to at least read the story. And then, of course, I did not realize that I was entering into that Hickey mode, that little Abner role, because I didn't type. My friends in Beaufort heard about the New York agent. They ran over. My wife gave them a chapter, each chapter. They typed it up. There was onion skin paper. There was yellow paper. There was line paper. I sent the manuscript out, and he thought Gomer Pyle was sending him this manuscript. He took it, and the story he tells over and over again is he called me up and said, Houghton Mifflin, who published Emerson and Thoreau, has taken your book for publication. And here's the great news, $7,500. And I said, in my incredible innocence that I cannot explain to anybody, except Beaufort, South Carolina, did not have much publishing knowledge. I said, Julian, I don't think Willie Shepherd down at Beaufort Bank is going to lend me that much money. Julian said, Pat, you do realize they pay you. And this was my first lesson in major publishing.
That's a wonderful, wonderful story. The great Santini, of course, your father is very thinly veiled as Santini. And, of course, your father appears again in The Prince of Tides. But I understand, in reading some of the biographical data that Houghton Mifflin sent over, that he doesn't seem to be a bit upset today. His characterization is rather rough, a gruff exterior, and yet there's something in him that is also extremely lovable and likable. A man who has it both ways, in effect.
Dad now considers himself a literary figure. And he said the stupidest thing in the history of literature was that I killed him off at the end of The Great Santini. He wanted sequels, and he wanted miniseries to come out of this. And The Great Santini goes to the circus, The Great Santini. So Dad, in the way he can do that, I don't understand how, has simply gone along with it. He gives speeches now to Marine Corps groups, to even child-rearing groups. And Dad has become a rather sort of a Nazi Dr. Spock, going around telling people how to raise their kids, raise them tough, with discipline, tough love. And his theory is that if he'd hit me more as I was a child, I'd be a much better writer today.
Well, he's not going to hit you anymore. You're an awfully big man.
I'm so glad. And he's going to be an older man.
Well, your father's not that old. He's not even
66. Dad is 66.
66.
Yeah, he just turned 66.
Well, you don't treat your kids that way.
No, I don't hit my kids, but as he says, they won't turn out as good as mine is.
Well,
Dad's very competitive on this.
At least he wasn't wishy-washy.
He was not wishy-washy.
Dad. All right, now let's go to The Prince of Tides. You obviously were not going to abandon your role as a writer. You had successes. Your books have been made into motion pictures. And The Prince of Tides, of course, is your most ambitious work to date. It's a long book. Tell me how this evolved in your mind and why you began to sit down and write this book.
It happened when I, in about 1953, we were driving, my parents and I were driving through South Carolina when my mother pointed out a town to me. And she said, they moved that town. And a town doesn't make it once it's been moved. And what she was talking about was Ellenton, South Carolina, which was actually physically moved by the federal government when they put in the Savannah River Project that was going to make plutonium for all the weapons in the United States. I always remembered that story, and I just started out with that colonel. What I did not realize was the story would start building. I did not realize there would be a shrimping family. I did not realize there would be some Tom Wingo coach going to New York. And these stories just grow. They usually start with an idea, and they start, these accretions start taking place like a coral reef, and they start building. And another story will hook into it. Another one will move into that, and the story will build itself. And I thought it was going to be a very short book. But it started building so quickly that it got where I almost couldn't control it.
Well, but you did control it, because the information about the moving of that town comes very, very close to the end. So you have a lot of material way at the beginning. So you must have, you couldn't have just started writing and let it grow.
No,
you must have planned that very carefully.
I knew to get up to the moving of the town, to make that believable, I had to have some beginning. And I had to have something. And I simply started out with one scene, and it grew into that thing. But it took 5 years for it to grow into the moving of the town before I thought it would be believable at all.
The dolphin story.
The white porpoise.
The porpoise rescued. Was that based on something?
Yes. The white porpoise swam. It was Carolina Snow. Swam in the waters around Beaufort, South Carolina when I was in high school, and was captured when I was a senior by a boat from the Miami Seaquarium. They came up to get the only albino porpoise that they knew existed in the world. And you can now go down to the Miami Seaquarium and see the porpoise mounted up on a wall, and with information given that it was taken in Beaufort, South Carolina in 1963.
It would have been nice to have headed that off, huh?
Yes.
Had Luke and Tom and Savannah.
And that was imagination. That's where the imagination of the novelist comes in.
When you wrote on these long yellow pads, you had to discipline yourself. What kind of day did you structure for yourself as you developed this book?
Try to do it, because I have 100 children, I try to do it after the kids go off to school. I would go back to the writing room, and I would try to do it like a business day, you know, from 9 to 12, break for lunch. Go back and try to do it from about 1 to 4. And I tried to, that was the day that was perfect. Sometimes it didn't work. Sometimes it didn't, nothing came out of that day. But that was the schedule I tried to keep for myself, and the one that once I began writing in earnest, the one I kept almost every day.
But now in Rome, so many distractions. How are you going to follow that schedule?
It's going to be harder in Rome. It's going to be much, much harder.
But that's a temporary arrangement.
I think so. I think we'll just be there for a couple of years.
Are you going to remain a Southern writer? Are you going to go back?
I guess so. It's hard to wipe that stuff out.
You can go any place you want, can't you?
You could, but the one thing that I know is that, you know, by moving to Italy, I won't become an Italian writer. I mean, I know that the South follows you. It's like a camel's hump. You sort of carry that with you wherever you go.
Well, you also have some more to write about, too, don't you?
You sure do.
Styron did. What was that book? Set This House on Fire.
Set This House on Fire. He wrote about, that was set in Italy, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Is it Set This House on Fire? What was his first one?
Okay.
Yeah, set his house on fire, but it was the second book, and that was set mostly in Italy. So, I mean, that's something more you can draw on. You'll have, in The Prince of Tides, you have some of it set outside the United States during the war.
That's right, in Germany and in New York.
Yeah, so it would not be unusual for you to have a Southern character going to Rome and having experiences and whatever, so I can see where you're certainly going to milk it. You're not going to let it go to waste, are you?
Well, I certainly hope I grow into where I do not have to write about a Southern. That would be a nice thing, I think.
Well, of course, it's refreshing to read about Southerners, because I'm really tired of reading about books set in New York and the whole thing set in New York. I really am. It's and as a matter of fact, I was interviewing a writer some time ago from San Francisco, and he wrote a book about an office tower that collapsed. And the whole book was about it was like a raging, a towering inferno.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And he's from San Francisco, and yet he set the book here. He came to New York to do his research. He came here for about 3 weeks or a month to get the streets right and all of that. And I said, well, why did you set it in New York? I mean, you could have set it in San Francisco. It's not the best place because so many books are set there. Well, what about Houston? It's got all sorts of skyscrapers there and nothing to hold them up, just marshy, you know, and perfect. He said, no, no. He says, I had to set it in New York. He said, people have heard of New York, and they know where it is. You know, it captures the imagination. But those of us who live here have to read about Buford, South Carolina. It's much. Well, listen, it's great talking to you. I enjoyed the book a lot. And are you having fun?
Yeah, I'm having fun. I'm trying to enjoy this tour totally, meeting different people, eating at great restaurants. And so I have. I've been enjoying it so far.
Well, as long as you're enjoying it, some people don't, and some people just eat it up. And because you look like the kind of guy who might enjoy it, and I think that's important that you do that. You get some ancillary benefits out of the publicity. Pat Conroy, thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure being here.